Good afternoon. It's very nice to see you.
Yeah, that's right.
A really large, lovely audience.
Always.
It's for a really fantastic panel. I also want to welcome our C-SPAN audience, who will be watching this excellent panel, which I want to address. First, introduce the different panelists. To my immediate right is Hillel Fradkin, a colleague here at Hudson Institute. To his right is Michael Duran, also senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And to his right, I want to welcome someone who has not been on our Hudson podium before, Liel Leibovitz. And I think that Liel is a colleague of mine at Tablet Magazine. And I think that Liel is going to have a very interesting perspective. Of course, Hillel and Michael as well. But Liel, I should say, it's not noted in the it's not noted in the identifications. But Liel's family is from Jerusalem. is from Jerusalem for many, many years, for forever. So I think that he'll be able to, in addition to giving an interesting historical perspective, he'll also have a very interesting personal perspective as well on June 1967, which is, and that's what the panel is about today, 6 days of fire. Israel and the June 1967 war, 50 years on. Again, welcome, and why don't we take it away? Hillel, if you would begin.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. We are here primarily to talk about the long-term consequences of the Six-Day War, and rightly so. But we thought it well to speak of the war itself and the situation on the eve of its outbreak. And that has fallen to me. Among other reasons, I'm old enough to remember it from direct experience. And it was an experience so dramatic and moving that it is very hard to forget. I had fresh reminders of it last week during a visit to Israel, most of all on Jerusalem Day, the annual celebration of the unification of the city. The natural starting point for considering the war is the situation of Israel in the spring of 1967 and a few reminders of its history to that date. At that time, Israel was a 19-year-old experiment, an experiment in Jewish statehood. That experiment was formally launched by the UN in November of 1947. In other words, Israel's establishment was authorized in the mode of international multilateralism that we now tend to regard as sacrosanct, something that I think is forgotten about Israel. Nevertheless, it remained an experiment for several reasons. The Arab states that were its neighbors were utterly opposed to its existence, and even those who had initially supported Israel's establishment by the UN, including the US, came to doubt the merits of that support. Why? It was for reasons that were succinctly restated on the eve of the Six-Day War by Hugh Smythe, the American ambassador to Damascus. Quote, "On the scales we have Israel, an unviable client whose value to the U.S. is primarily emotional, balanced with the full range of the vital strategic, political, commercial, and economic interests represented by Arab states." This view was powerful in 1948. It anticipated that the Arab states on Israel's border, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and even implausibly Lebanon, and others besides would attack and seek to murder the Israeli state in its cradle. Israel seemed less an experiment than a fool's errand. And the Arab states did attack. Israel managed to survive the Arab War of 1948. But Israel's survival did not mean peace. For the next 19 years, the Arab states continued to reject any peace with Israel and attacked it wherever and whenever possible, principally by terrorist cross-border attacks. But their ultimate aim, freely announced, was to destroy Israel completely, to finish, as they put it, the business of 48, to remove the shame of 48. Still, until 67, that aim remained unfulfilled and was not attempted. It was thought to require a grand coalition of Arab armies, such as had been put together in 1948. Only then could Israel's Arab enemies launch a full-scale attack and achieve their ultimate goals. But until 67, these conditions were not achieved and could not be. The most important reason was that the army of Egypt, the largest Arab army, could not be deployed to Israel's borders. It could not be because of the outcome of war in 1956, a war in which Israel was allied with Britain and France against Egypt. The armistice that ended that war provided for the partial demilitarization of the Sinai Peninsula, supervised by a UN peacekeeping force that acted, or was supposed to act, as a buffer. It also provided for the right of navigation through the Straits of Tiran for Israeli shipping. All that changed in the middle of May 1967, and fairly abruptly. A crisis erupted that lasted 3 long weeks and culminated in the Six-Day War. The immediate crisis was set in motion by Egypt and its president, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Egypt reintroduced its army into the Sinai. It demanded and received the withdrawal of the UN force. Its forces moved closer to the Israeli border. Egypt formed a military alliance with Syria, which had a lot to do with the instigation of the crisis, with a completely bogus claim that Israel was about to attack it. Subsequently, Jordan joined this alliance, placing its army under Egyptian command. This was a particularly painful blow to Israel, for Jordan then ruled what is today called the West Bank. The location of the West Bank meant that in some places in central Israel, Israel's width was only 9 miles. An attack from this quarter could sever Israel and destroy its coastal cities. In the event that attack came, the encirclement of Israel was now complete, as it had been in 48. The whole Arab world was electrified by the prospect of a new war, and many countries rushed to join the fray, especially Iraq, which sent its forces into Jordan. Nasser took a final fateful step by closing the Straits of Tiran to Israel. Nasser knew and announced that this was tantamount to a declaration of war and welcomed the onset of that war, confident that he would win it. Its goal was forcefully stated by President Arif of Iraq, quote, "Our goal is clear, to wipe Israel off the face of the map. We shall, God willing, meet in Tel Aviv and Haifa." Such a vision was repeated over and over by Nasser and all other Arab leaders, and was, I can remember vividly, available to people in the United States to hear. In Israel, the government deliberated about what to do. Anyone who thinks that it took the decision to go eventually to war lightly should just consult the record. It could have no doubts that it faced the prospect of a war of extermination. At one point in the 3 weeks, Rabin Yitzhak Rabin, who was chief of staff, said, "It's now a question of to be or not to be." But apart from making military preparations, it took no definitive decision. Some in the government hoped that a peaceful resolution might be found. But in that event, Israel might have to accept the new status quo, Egypt's army on its border, and could not hope that even that status quo would be maintained. Its Arab enemies would conclude that Israel was afraid of a fight and could still, and probably would still, attack sometime later at a time of their choosing. At all events, an acceptable peaceful resolution depended upon outside parties, and thus Israel undertook a major diplomatic effort, which lasted throughout those 3 weeks. For Israelis in general, the long wait of 3 weeks grew increasingly painful. It was painful for many of those who sympathized with Israel as well. People were obliged to wonder whether they were about to witness a new Holocaust, some 20 years after the previous one. Confidence in the government faltered. eventually, to restore confidence, a unity government was formed, and Moshe Dayan, hero of 56, was appointed Minister of Defense. In Israeli memory, this period has its own name, Ahamtana, the waiting. In the end, the diplomatic efforts were a total and complete failure. Israel and its 3 million people found that it faced its encirclement alone, totally and utterly alone. Several of the Arab states had the Soviet Union as an ally, but Israel found it had no allies worthy of the name. France's Charles de Gaulle curtly repudiated an old alliance with Israel as well as the 1957 guarantees. His phrase at the time, 67 is not 57. Britain was sympathetic, but offered no help, and effectively left its own guarantees in abeyance. America, too, was sympathetic, but not yet the ally it would come to be, even in terms of armaments. All of Israel's planes were French at the time, and most of its tanks were British. The attitude of President Johnson and his principal advisors was warmer than that expressed in the judgment I cited earlier, that of U.S. Ambassador Smythe. But it was informed by the same cold logic, augmented by Cold War concerns, the possibility of a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union. After much consultation, the most President Johnson was willing to offer were continued efforts at mediation and a warning not to begin hostilities. His repeated message was, and this is a direct quote, "Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go it alone." But Israel eventually regarded such a stance in the absence of real American support as untenable, and rightly so. In the end, on June 5th, Israel did go it alone, all alone, and prevailed all alone in a remarkable military campaign fought on three fronts. It was a spectacular victory by every measure, and there have been many descriptions of it. Let me offer one written by the well-known historian of World War I, Barbara Tuchman, who visited Israel both before and shortly after the war. Quote, "A people considered for centuries non-fighters carried out in June, against long odds, the most nearly perfect military operation in modern history. Surrounded on three sides, facing vast superiority in numbers and amount of armament, fighting alone against enemies supported and equipped by a major power, and having lost the advantage of surprise, they accomplished the rarest of military feats, the attainment of exact objectives, in this case, the shattering of the enemy's forces and the securing of defensible lines within a given time and with absence of blunder." Not quite with the absence of blunder, but that's a longer story. We will now move to a discussion of the long-term consequences of this victory, but I would like to close with one observation about its immediate consequences for Israel at that time and also following on. No doubt Israel would have preferred a less lonely path to security, the security it achieved through that war. But in having to go it alone, it proved to itself two important things, and maybe to others: that it was not a mere client state, nor was it unviable. It had a chance, if regrettably necessarily a fighting chance, to be what it declares in its national anthem, to be a free people in its land. Beyond survival, there is a special virtue in that, and even a model in that. And in the last 50 years, Israel has made the most of that virtue. Thank you.
Thanks, Lal. That's terrific. Thanks very much. Mike, if you would like to follow up.
Thanks. I'll say a few words about the Egyptian role in all of this, and then have a couple of reflections on the long-term meaning of the war. There's a kind of enduring mystery about the outbreak of the war, because everyone agrees that this is Nasser's war. When I say everyone, to prove that, there's the historian Avi Schleim. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Avi Schleim has never had a sympathetic word to say about Israel. And in his history of the of the Arab-Israeli conflict, even he can't but assign responsibility for the 67 war to Nasser. And it's impossible because at every stage of the conflict, Nasser escalated. When people were trying to borrow a phrase from President Obama, offer him an off-ramp, he didn't take the off-ramp, and he kept escalating. And the mystery in all of this is why did he do it? Because at the time, the best units of his army were bogged down in a war in Yemen. So he was totally unprepared for this conflict and couldn't have won it. And yet he escalated and escalated to the point where after he's remilitarized the Sinai, he basically says Israel has no choice. But I think we have put Israel in a position where it has no choice but to attack. And so you either have to say he's totally irrational, or he was playing a game that we don't understand very well. And I'll just give you a couple of thoughts about what I think the game he was playing was. I think that this may be one of the questions that people will never be able to answer. Maybe somebody will answer it definitively, but it's kind of a mystery that is continues to intrigue me. And I think perhaps because a little bit of self-interest, I just wrote a book about 1956.
I think
the key is 1956.
No, I was going to mention that also, that yeah. you have deep yeah. insight into thought about Nasser from that period on.
I do have a tendency to see everything as going back to 1956.
The title of the book is Ike's Gamble, still available from booksellers.
But in 56, Nasser lost the war against Israel, but he won politically. Right. Britain, France, and Israel teamed up against Egypt. He defeated the Egyptian army, but the superpowers got involved, and the United States, in particular, forced the Israelis out of the Israelis occupied all the Sinai. They forced them out with minimal concessions. The concessions being the ones that Nasser overturned in 67, meaning the placement of the United Nations Emergency Force in Sinai and guarantees about shipping in the Straits of Tehran. I think that's the key. That's the world in which that was Nasser's greatest moment. The rise of Nasser as a kind of unstoppable political force in the Arab world was 1956. And America handed him this incredible political victory. And so I think in 67, he thought he could replay 56. He thought that he could escalate things to such a point that even if there was a conflict with Israel, a conflict that he might not win on the ground, he would still come out the political winner. So his major miscalculation, he made two major miscalculations in 67. One of them clearly was the military miscalculation. The Israelis destroyed his air force in record time, and they did it alone. See, in 56 they had the French to help them in the air. In 67 they didn't. They did it all alone, and it was, as Barbara Tuchman said, a near perfect military operation. And so they obliterated his forces so quickly that there wasn't time for the superpowers to step in and hand him a victory to snatch defeat for the Israelis from the jaws of their military victory. The second miscalculation he made was about the Americans. Since he had encountered the Americans back from when he took power in 1952. The Americans had been completely allergic to association with Zionism. They were afraid to be seen to be on the side of the Israelis in a war against the Arabs, and they were very eager to distance themselves from Israel. And that's what generated Eisenhower's decision in 56 to roll them out of the Sinai. By 67, that had changed considerably. There were still such impulses in the State Department, for sure, absolutely. But I once had
Mr. Smythe,
those attitudes were well represented. But I had a discussion with Harold Saunders once, former Foreign Service officer who was had been the chief of staff, I believe it was, to Henry Kissinger, and he was among those who he was the assistant secretary for the Near East at one point, and Saunders was among those who was very interested in maintaining good relations with Nasser and believed that the U.S. association with Israel was poisoning the relations with Nasser, and he told me that Nasser gave a speech in 1966, I believe it was, in which he said, in which it was full of fire and brimstone and defiance of the Americans, and he said a line in there that, and if the Americans don't like it, they can go drink the Red Sea, right? So no, they can take a flying leap. And Saunders said that from that moment, for some reason, I don't know why, I never went to research the exact moment of that speech and why it had such an effect, but Saunders told me that from that moment on, the Americans were at the highest level were done with Nasser, right? The idea, he said, none of us could possibly put forward a proposal to woo Nasser because he had so undermined his own position in Washington, and that was against the background of this war in Yemen. The war in Yemen was a superpower proxy fight. So the Americans, the Saudis, and the Yemeni royalists were on one side, and the Soviets, the Egyptians, and the insurgents were on the other side in Yemen. And we saw it in those terms, and so when Nasser blundered into this war, if you will, or if you want to say he provoked this war for whatever purposes he provoked it, the Americans were not sympathetic at all. And there you find something very interesting. Right when the war ends, the U.S. Comes up with, and working with the Soviets, but it's an American idea, comes up with UN Resolution 242, and to the essence of 242 is territory for peace. This remains the basic idea to this day about how to make peace between Israel and its neighbors. And that's it's a very simple, commonsensical idea, but it's antithetical to the viewpoint that was dominant in Washington back in 56, when it was, get Israel out of the Sinai in return for no concessions from Nasser. We can't be seen to be using Israeli military power in order to get concessions from the Egyptians. Once that idea is eroded, that paves the way for the concept that you later saw in the Nixon administration, where Nixon and Henry Kissinger saw Israeli military power, which was, as Hillel explained, proved itself in 67 as an asset for the United States, yeah, in the Cold War, where we can use it to put pressure on the allies of the Soviet Union, and if they want to be relieved of pressure from the Israeli military, they have to come to us, right? The Soviet Union can't help them with that, only we can help with that. Now, we weren't quite there in 67, but once you get to the land for peace idea, that's the beginning of the idea that Israeli power is actually a benefit to the United States strategically and not a liability, which is an incredibly important turning point. Now, just a couple of other thoughts about the turning point, and then I'll pass it over to Liel. One is, as you hear me talking, saying Soviet Union, United States, and so on, it was another world, right? It was the height of the Cold War, and this was the Middle East was a proxy proxy arena in the Cold War, and that world is gone. There's something else that happened in 67. The biggest winner in 1967 was not the Israelis. The biggest winner in 1967 were the Saudis. And it's kind of interesting if you think about where we are where we are today. Because after 67, the Arabs meet at Khartoum, the famous Khartoum Pan-Arab Summit, which produced the famous three no's of Khartoum, no recognition of Israel, no negotiations with Israel, and no peace with Israel. That was the public slogan of Khartoum. Behind the scenes, the real work took place, and the real work was that the Egyptians made a rapprochement with the Saudis. They had been so defeated, so humiliated by the Israelis that they had to start thinking about pulling out of Yemen, and they cut a deal with the Saudis where they agreed to end their propaganda against the Saudi monarchy, and in return, the Saudis started giving them money, which is marks the turning point. You know, until that moment, the Egyptians were, Egypt was the center of the Arab world. It was the dominant power in the Arab world. And 67 really marks the moment when the Saudis sort of come into their own. And that's the world we know today, where among the Arabs, we always think of the Saudis as being the leading power. The other big change that takes place, and then I'll pass it to Liel, or two others, I'll quickly. One is, obviously, I've already said it in not in so many words, this is effectively the end of Nasserism. Nasser dies 3 years later, but the idea of Egypt as the leader of the Arab world and the leading power against the Israelis, it's already starting to shift here. We do have the 73 war, which is, of course, a huge trauma for the Israelis and in many ways a more, you know, greater existential threat than 67 was. But 73 is interesting if you look at it from the Egyptian point of view, because the goal of 73 was to get out of the conflict, was to deal a big enough blow to Israel that it would wake up the superpowers and make them come in to help the Egyptians get out of the conflict. It wasn't to use the conflict for other purposes as the Egyptians were doing in 67. It was really to get out of the conflict. Of course, we have I don't want to be too teleological about it. You have the war of attrition and then the 73 war, which from an Israeli point of view, both of them were very serious conflicts. But from an Egyptian point of view, you can see that something shifts dramatically in 67. And then the last point I'll make is that as the Egyptians move out of the, start thinking about how to get out of this conflict, they start playing up the point that this conflict at its essence is a conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And that it's a question of national determination for the Palestinian people rather than a conflict of Egypt and Arabism against imperialism and Israel is an outpost for imperialism and so on and so forth. The Arabs in general redefine it as Palestinian nationalism versus Israel, which brings the PLO to the fore, and that leads us to the peace process that we're familiar with from post 73 on, which focuses on the Palestinian issue.
Thanks, Mike. That's terrific. I'd never thought about Resolution 242 as kind of being the premise of that's how the United States would eventually look at Israel as a Cold War asset. And so that's really interesting.
Thanks,
Liel.
Thank you.
You could
round of applause. All right.
Thanks. So, you know, as Lee mentioned, my family has been in Jerusalem for a while. They arrived sometime in the 50s, the 1750s, which means mainly that, you know, Jerusalem syndrome has run in the family for about 9 or 10 generations there. So what I'm about to say today is going to sound, I hope, profoundly crazy, especially next to my two studious and serious colleagues. The first thing that I would like to say, and it is perhaps a tad uncharitable in an event dedicated to the colossal historical meaning of 1967, is that 1967 actually mattered not a bit. And here is why I say that. I say that because I went to school in Tel Aviv University, which was established over the ruins of three Palestinian villages that were destroyed and abandoned in 1948. And so if you're looking for some sort of vantage point at which to start telling some sort of meaningful story about contemporary Israel, about the Middle East and Israel's place in it. 67 seems a bit arbitrary. For that matter, 48 does as well. I'm not a batting man, but if I were, my money would be somewhere around 1897, when the first major group of Jews descended from the first ship and started the first real movement called the First Aliyah to repopulate in a massive way the much too promised land with its previous inhabitants. I think that in a way, what 67 did is provide this kind of major, almost distraction. Hillel had a beautiful phrase that I'm going to bungle, so I'm not even going to try. But it had to do with multilateralism. I think it provided a deeply comforting prism through which to look at this conflict, because now we're looking at it and we're seeing something that is solvable. Here's a problem, and if only we poured enough, you know, goodwill into it, thinks John Kerry before he falls asleep at night, we can make this work, because this is a problem of negotiations between two sides that are profoundly willing to negotiate some sort of solution. I think both people increasingly and understandably have a very different perspective, and in a sense have always had that perspective. I think that the Israelis may be looking at their neighbors and saying, well, do you remember the Jebusites and the Hittites? These were once mighty people. They're nowhere to be seen. We could wait. We have all the time in the world. And I think the Palestinians are looking at the Israelis and saying, oh yeah, well, do you remember the Ottomans and the Brits? Those were once mighty empires who occupied this land too. We could wait, because we too have all the time in the world. I think that is a much more, to use a favorite term, organic way of understanding the reality that both peoples had. And in a way, 67 had been this kind of major 50-year detour in which everyone's like, but this resolution and this negotiation and this process, and how could we solve it? And I think we're kind of slowly climbing away from that. Interestingly enough, that's not the really crazy thing that I have to say. The really crazy thing that I would like to say is sort of contradictory, of course, to the first thing. And that is,
it will
that
prove
in,
that you're crazy.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. In one very, very important and non-trivial way, 67 mattered a tremendous deal. It mattered a tremendous deal because it revealed, and I use, you know, I use this term in all of its, might say teleological, I like that term, but almost theological awe to many Israelis in a strange way, the true purpose of their national project. Try asking today, 146 years after the Risorgimento, try asking Italians how many of them identify as Garibaldists. And they look at you saying, you know, what are you talking about? And at the same time, an overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews strongly define themselves as Zionists, which, if you think about it, is almost absurd if you understand Zionism as a political movement to reestablish a Jewish homeland in the state of Israel. Well, that mission, to quote another great American thinker, has been accomplished, you know, sometime between 60-odd years ago or 50 years ago. That mission has been secured. Once the modern state of Israel has been established, why are we still talking about ourselves as Zionists? The answer that I would like to give, and it has its origins in a very, very good book, almost as good as Mike's, which is the Bible, is that the mission of Zionism has never been solely political. I'm almost tempted to say not even mainly political. The mission of Zionism has always been to fulfill, here comes the crazy part, the messianic yearnings that are at the very core of the historical thrust and the religious belief that have kept Jews as Jews as a people. This is the reason why this kind of ragtag movement attracted people whose vision of what kind of state they would eventually establish were radically different. You had, you know, Marxists who wanted this kind of, you know, utopia. You had religious Jews. You had cultural Jews. You had people who agreed not a lick about what type of polity would actually come to fruition once this great big miracle occurs, and yet they comfortably banded together and continue to band together under this banner. The reason for this, and I will not get, you know, too philosophical here, but the reason for this is because the contract, the reason for the return, the reason for the yearning, always had to do not just with the establishment of a national homeland for purposes of self-definition, defense, etc., but rather for the fulfillment of some deeper religious understanding, meaning that the nation did not just have to be a nation, but it had to be a perfect nation. This is why when Moses sends 10 spies and they return and they say, dude, not so much milk and honey, a lot of angry people who really want to kill us. Moses kills them because they fail to understand that what makes the promised land promised isn't some inherent quality. What makes the promised land promised is our ability to inhabit it and make it an exemplary place for a higher type of living here on earth. And so up until 1967, it was very easy for a majority of Israelis to simply ignore this notion, because indeed it sounds rather untenable and rather sort of emotionally mentally unstable. Up until 1967, it was quite possible to focus on what appeared to be, and indeed were, I don't want to belittle them, real existential challenges of anything from strategic depth to, you know, kind of building this, and I love what Hillel used, that this continuing this experiment. 67 unleashed all that because it, in a weird way, removed the last barrier towards the understanding of the project. Something very, very interesting happened, and it happened literally. About a week and a half after the war, a host of rabbis got together in Jerusalem. And sort of still shaken by this great and unexpected victory. And I know this because some of my relatives were literally in the room. They contemplated whether now that this miraculous occurrence is upon us, it was perhaps time to change some of the prayers in classical Jewish liturgy that specifically speak of the destruction of Jerusalem and our kind of mourning for it. Whether it was time to remove some of these lines from the prayers. And they decided almost unanimously, which is very hard for Jews to do on anything, especially on things like that, that the prayers ought not to be changed because the mission had not been accomplished, because the actual unification of the city was not the end. It was the beginning. It was now time to embark on the greater project, which has always been the project of Zionism, which is a creation of a more and more and more and more perfect union that, you know, expresses itself in such platitudes like light unto the nations. And I think 67 freed a lot of people to continue and do that. And the change in Israeli society and Israeli politics has been radical. Again, we're looking here at all the wrong things. The energy goes to, well, but what about the settlements? Would you move the settlements? Would they be beyond this line or that line? Are they seizing land? Is it in accordance with the Geneva Convention? Well, these are all very interesting questions that people have spent a lot of time kind of, you know, debating with. But the bigger and more intricate and more interesting change is the gradual but undeniable and very, very convincing shift that a huge swath of Israeli society has experienced in the last 50 years. I don't want to say towards religiosity, because that is a highly explosive term, but toward an increasing understanding that the nature of our national project isn't to build another, you know, Berlin or DC or Paris on the Mediterranean. It is something very, very different, and it has to do in some deeply intricate ways with faith, with Jewish faith, and in the way we understand it. This is why you could see all of a sudden weird hybrid huge political parties like the Jewish Home that have in them both, quote-unquote, traditionally religious politicians and very, quote-unquote, secular politicians, because the actual level of observance isn't, and in a weird way has never been, the yardstick. It's the coming together over the understanding that we're trying to do something very, very different. We're trying to build a Jewish state and understand it as such, and that the project is a project that has been defined not in June of 67, but in one June many, 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 many moons ago in Sinai. And 67 unleashed that yearning. It has freed us to do so, and the consequences of that are strangely far more outreaching than far-reaching than anything that I think anyone in this room could even begin to fathom.
That's great, Leo. Thanks very much. So, Leo, I want to stick with you for a second, then I want to come back to Mike and Hillel. What I want to now, since we've sort of we've led up to 1967. We're in the middle of 1967 with Hillel, Mike, and Leal. Now I want to look a little bit past that and just ask you to continue a little bit. Leal and I have been speaking before about this. So if you just want to continue a little bit more in this vein, what does it look like post-1967? Because in some ways, I think in some ways when we were speaking last night and also today, you're saying that at 67, everyone understood, it was very clear what the project was. Now, in Washington, in the U.S. press, people who are interested in Israel, look at Israel, you know the different things they say. Oh, is Israel becoming more religious? What does it look like? Is this a problem? Look at all these people. But you're saying that this became clear in 1967. What we're seeing now is I'm going to leave it to you to explain, but I just want to say, I'm going to ask Mike and Hillel to sort of describe also what the region has looked like since 67. Mike talked about that a bit. And also, let's talk a little bit about how American policy has changed since 1967, looking at Israel and the region generally. So, Hillel, if we can stick with you for a second.
So, this is something I learned a lot from Mike. For example, how much... if you think of America and how much of our political energies were consumed by the Cold War, and how the Cold War made possible alliances between parties that on the surface seemed to have very little in common, right? You had kind of traditional conservatives and traditional liberals coming together over what both could agree was a perceived threat that had to be met. And once that threat went away, all of a sudden, both of these camps had to define the true essence of their ideology. We're seeing the outcomes of that right now, since November, in grand operatic fashion. I think something similar happened in Israel. I think before 1967, many kind of parties, and this, by the way, I think is also very pertinent to big swaths of the American Jewish community, could weave together a narrative that was almost above reproach. It was a narrative of experimentation. Here's this 19-year-old nation. It is attempting some sort of David versus Goliath thing. It is still sufficiently steeped in its socialist background or history or roots for people of a very, very, very wide range of political affiliations to feel sort of this deep, deep affinity towards it. And that simply built huge coalitions and kind of created these camps in support for what was understood to be the project in ways that were fairly unproblematic. When 67 occurred, that kind of ceased to be the case, because then the questions that Israelis had to answer was a far starker one. Well, okay, we've removed the last barrier, quote-unquote, the last kind of big existential militaristic program. We have reunified Jerusalem. We are we're here, we're present, what now? And I think that big portions, although I think they're diminishing and dwindling daily, of the Israeli public said, well, now we are going to create a great nation state, and we are going to do it by passing laws that are widely understood, universally, cosmopolitanly, cosmically, to be the sort of laws that nation states that are responsible and progressive pass. And there was an equally large part, and growing larger by the day, that said, well, wait a minute. Yes, we do have a firm commitment to democratic principle, but at the same time, we also have an idea that this really is and has always been and ought to always remain a different kind of state. And in a way, all sorts of conflicts that never existed before begin to bubble to the surface. Questions about, you know, what is the nature of, you say, businesses on the Sabbath? Questions about the role of, you know, the rabbinate in public life? Questions about really kind of essential issues of defining what the state ought to be and how it ought to be. And that type of process, and we're seeing ripples of that happen still. And I think to get for a second to the kind of Jewish community abroad, I think that actually also sends shockwaves into much of world Jewry, and particularly American Jewry. I think one of the reasons that you're seeing so many young American Jews distance themselves from Israel today isn't because of the quote-unquote occupation. Because again, if you do believe that this is just a solution, you know, a problem awaiting its solution, you could advocate one or another. It's because I think the nation itself is becoming unrecognizable and insupportable, or insufferable even, to people whose identity is so thoroughly universalist, secular, cosmopolitan, as to not recognize a project that is a thoroughly Jewish project, unabashedly, uncomplicatedly, proudly, religiously tinted nation state. That is a type of drama that in a way is not that different from dramas that we see everywhere from Brexit to here, right? It's a question of what type of essential nation you want to have. It has brewed, Israel is very frequently the canary in the coal mine, it has brewed in Israel about 50 years earlier than it did in the rest of the world, but Israel's answer was sort of very decisive in one direction, and now we're living out this drama.
Thanks, Dad. That's fantastic. I want to go to Mike for a second, because Mike has, it's a great transition, because Mike has just written a really interesting, very interesting article on Europe, partly having to do with Brexit. And I know you've been thinking about this for a while, as well as your excellent work on the Middle East, but about Europe and the United States and what these different ideas of nationalism, how they're playing out. I'm curious to know if Israel has been an example in this way, and if this was coming out of 1967, this was an instance that while part of the world was moving this way towards globalization, towards lack of borders, that Israel after 67 was showing one thing, and now this is what we're seeing both in Europe and in the United States.
I wouldn't have thought to connect up those things in this conversation, but I think I can do it at the risk of...
I'm so sorry, man.
It's interesting. I think I can do it without being too reductive. There are two schools of thought which go back to 67 in America about Israel. And one school of thought says that Israel is a strategic liability to the United States. And the other one says Israel is a strategic asset. And the school that says that Israel is a liability also says at the same time that it's a liability, and it is the central issue. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict, is the central strategic issue in the Middle East. And what makes it a liability? It's a liability because our association with Israel is alienating the Arabs and the Muslims and the entire Third World, writ large. And even further, it's alienating us from, these days you'd hear, you know, in the halls of the State Department, it's alienating us from the European Union and so on. And there's a kind of community of nations out there, and we have to be responsive to its concerns. And so, therefore, the job of the United States is to peace process, right? The peace process is a strategically central aspect of American policy. Even if, and I think President Obama, if you read his comments carefully, was pretty explicit about this. Our job is the peace process, even if we don't believe that at the end of this process there's going to be a peace, right? Because this is the kind of outreach that we do. This is the way that we show respect for the community of nations. And behind that idea is the kind of universalist idea that Liel is saying, the more secular, use the word rootless cosmopolitan, I think, the cosmopolitanism of the of Jewish youth in America today, the kind of globalist globalist community. On the other side, the people who say that Israel is not a liability and that it's an asset. That frame of reference or that position resonates very deeply with American nationalists, right? And evangelicals are religious people. So the unification of Jerusalem in 67, that was a religious event for the Jews, but it was also a religious event for Gentiles. And all along the way, from the beginning of the Zionist project, there has been a strong Gentile Zionism that has supported the project. Our colleague here, Walter Russell Reed, drew everyone's attention to something in 1891 called the Blackstone Memorial. William Blackstone was a famous American businessman. He made a lot of money and grew up very poor. Made a lot of money in real estate. When he made enough money to live for comfortably forever, he devoted his life to Jesus. He wrote a book, Jesus is Coming, analyzing the Ecclesiastes to show that the return of Jesus was prophesied and near. That book was a bestseller for years in America. He then, in 1891, petitioned the president and said the Ottoman Empire is crumbling. It's the job of the United States. This is 5 years before, 4 years before Herzl's Jewish state, that the Ottoman Empire is crumbling. It's the job of the United States to return the Jews to the promised land. That letter was signed by the editor of the New York Times. Things have changed. The editor of the New York Times, the editor of the Washington Post. Again, things have changed. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the American political, commercial, intellectual elite all signed that. So there's a strain that may have diminished somewhat in America, but it's still there. America is a pro-Israel country, and if you just need to, many of you perhaps are not tuning into Mike Huckabee, but Mike Huckabee is more in tune with that America, right? It's still out there, and politicians are very much aware of it. And that America says that it's in the national interest of the United States to support Israel. So a lot of what we do in Washington, we think we're these different positions that we're taking about Israel are, strategic positions about, you know, all these arguments over settlements and everything are about bringing peace between Israelis and Palestinians, and they are certainly that. But they're also signposts in a big cultural battle between two Americas, one that's part of this globalist, universalist effort, and another one that says, America, by God.
Halal, if I can ask you, so what did that argument look like, the argument that Mike is describing? What did it look like in Washington since 67, the argument between, you know, the argument in Washington between American policymakers, some who are saying Israel is a strategic ally, Israel is a strategic liability? What are the different And how did that play regarding the, you know, how did that play regarding our relations also with Arab states and Muslim states?
If I may, I think I'll decline to address that.
Okay.
Okay, because I think Mike has, you know, probably defined what the framework of discussion has been. It seems to me that, but in general, over time, the strategic asset or the strategic liability argument has gotten stronger, and it's gotten stronger partially because of many circumstances that have changed in the world. The ongoing collapse of the Middle East into violence and so forth has not made arrangements with the Middle East look all that attractive, and therefore the fact that we are not, we're losing out on a chance to be cozy with people who don't like Israel has looked, you know, like less substantial. I did want to comment on a couple of things that both Liel and Mike have said, which I think are really quite important. Since Liel offered us a midrash or a homily, I'm inclined to address him as Reb Liel, but that might insult Mike, so I'll call him Reb Mike. And these are somewhat separate points, but Mike, I think, is correct in saying that the crucial factor here was Egypt, and I think properly traces the source of Nasser's approach to what had happened in 56, or for that matter, what happened in 48. He was a soldier who was captured during the 48 war by the Israeli army. I'm less sure that he didn't think that the Egyptian army could, and the Arab forces in general, could win. And that's connected with, I mean, he no doubt wasn't completely unaware of some of the difficulties. But I think his confidence, or such confidence that he had in an Arab victory, came from the way in which what was wrong about Israel in the first place. That is, I referred before to the shame of 48. The shame of 48 was that Jews had beaten Arabs and Muslims. And there remained, that seemed at first impossible. And it was explained away twice, first in 48 by claimed complicity of imperialist powers. The same thing happened in 56. And that had a very strong, that argument was made by them, and I think it also persuaded them that they really had never faced Israel in a fair fight, because if they did, they could take them, because Jews are not fighters, as Mrs. Stuckman said. And so whatever reservations he had, as things went on in the crisis during the 3 weeks, everything conspired to encourage, you know, give him confidence, further confidence. Everyone was backing off. And what is very significant then is the defeat. Because the defeat, first of all, it doesn't dispel that argument that Israel only survives because it has foreign, European, Christian, whatever, imperialist support, but it becomes more and more implausible. And that leads, as you said, to the sort of decline of Nasserism altogether and the rise of the Saudis, but also, and this goes along with it, you didn't state it, but I'm sure it was implied in it, the rise of an alternative vision of what is Middle East politics should be, which is Islamist, a reconciliation with the Islamist forces in Egypt in particular, that's undertaken by Anwar Sadat, and all the subsequent developments. The last thing about on that score I want to say is the shift to the Palestinian issue. I think it always bears emphasizing that when the Arabs attacked in 48 and when they attacked or were about to attack in 67, the goal always was to destroy the Jewish state. It was to destroy Israel. It was not to establish a Palestinian state. And had it been so, there would have been one in 48 after the fighting had stopped. Had they won in 67, I think it's 100-1 against them having established a Palestinian state then. They would have done what they did in 48. The various victors would have divided up the spoils. The odd thing about Israel's victory is that it paradoxically created the conditions for the establishment of a Palestinian state, because the Arabs would have done it. And in fact, that's sort of happened. Gaza is a Palestinian state, and maybe there'll be a Palestinian state in the West Bank. So it had that bizarre effect within the contours of what came to be the Palestinian initiative of the Arab states. On Reb Liel's observations, first of all, in large part, I think you're correct. I would say that and you're also correct that the people who built Israel, founded Israel, I mean, from, say, the late 19th century on, there were great differences among them. They did share one thing in common, a kind of crazy messianic or utopian, not messianic, it was utopian, because only some of them believed a messiah would bring it. But after that, there was considerable room for disagreement. They didn't all pull together so easily. My own parents were members of the far-left party, Mapam, and I'm sure that, they didn't, or their friends, they were fairly moderate in their views, but some of their friends certainly didn't have fellow feeling with the other utopian streams. But what they did have, and this is, I think, one can't forget that you're right in a way that the project has reached a certain goal, the founding of the state. But then the state takes on a reality, a real reality, so that, for example, communists or left-wing Mapamniks could fight shoulder to shoulder with religious guys in 67 and in 73 and so forth. They feel that bond. In fact, the question or your observation is extremely important, but I think it's very complicated. Probably we can't explore it adequately here. I think there are two things involved. One is, and this particularly pertains, I think, to your remark about the divide between American Jews and Israel. In the course of creating a state, they also created a different type of person. And Israelis, I think this was noticeable a long time ago. It took on it was denominated with the term Sabra, that there's a different type of Israeli personality.
Anu banu artzon livnot v'lehi banot. Sorry,
but I think it's also true in general that Israeli Jews are different than other Jews, and it's a function of, first of all, of the experience of living in that country, and also of having to answer the question or have an answer to the question you pose: what is the mission of Israel? Is it merely to be a modern nation state along the lines of other modern nation states, or is it to have something distinctively Jewish about it? And by the way, since you cited the Bible, that tension is there in the Bible from the get-go. It isn't just a bromide to speak of a light unto the nations. So, but in Israel, that issue has to be worked out in a living through living experience. In the United States, you get your choice. You can be, you can accommodate yourself to one side of the equation that Mike describes so very well. Enlightened, modern, postmodern, universalist, and so forth, or live in those parts of Williamsburg that haven't been taken over by hipsters. So you can choose. In Israel, that's not possible. And I think, I don't know how much Israelis misunderstand it. I'm pretty sure an enormous number of American Jews misunderstand this. Those aren't simply alternative choices in Israel, and they have to be worked through, and will be worked through. I mean, over time, perhaps, and the combination of the two, in the end, may look not so, should I put it, so repugnant to or alien to Americans or American Jews, but it will certainly be different. I mean, it may be. You talked about the creation of Paris or London on the Eastern Mediterranean. Really, the other option is Silicon Valley on the yes. on the Eastern Mediterranean. And Israelis of practically all religious persuasions gravitate to that. So that's over time we'll see what emerges from that.
Eyal, did you want to? I saw you taking notes. Did you want to respond to some of that?
Well, it's funny, right? Because I was telling Mike as the fire raged on, that in a way I didn't fully, even as I was sort of speaking, didn't fully anticipate that these connections would be made. But I'm wondering now. You said, in America you can make a choice. In Israel, it's less clear. I'm wondering again, going solely off the canary in the coal mine, theory of history here. Which is problematic and one that I don't fully subscribe to. But I'm actually wondering if the rest of the world actually has a choice or not. I'm wondering if these big cataclysmic elections that we're seeing now aren't basically the same conflict. And in a way, I don't think that, building Silicon Valley on the Mediterranean is in any way incompatible with choosing to live out a certain kind of nationalist values. I being myself firmly in one side of this debate, right? I don't particularly accept the assertion that, Enlightenment, not as a historical movement, but as a kind of, divine charge, lies or progress or all things good, true, and efficient lie necessarily with those who also advocate the kind of universalist, globalist approach. I think that part of the genius of Israel, and again, unleashed in 67 because the project then got so big, is that or the hurdles were removed that permitted these energies to go wild, is to do the kind of work that makes possible a country that could both develop new and interesting religious ways and Waze, the app that takes you from point A to point B.
Right, okay.
To me, that is a huge accomplishment and a huge project. I just wonder, to get back, though, to the original and big point, if this tension that Israelis have, I agree with you completely, by and large, resolved, isn't coming home across the world.
Well, let me, and that was, I think, Mike's thing about
right. I'm going to let Mike answer this.
Well, one of the things it seems to me is the case.
My answer is maybe.
I think what Israel has shown specifically represented in the turmoil of the last few years, but rather the turmoil more generally in the Western world is, and elsewhere, is the reflects the fact that, in a way, the globalist perspective, the idea that you're a citizen of the world is nonsense. And the reason for that is very simple. It's not that you couldn't imagine trying to be that. It's just that you've got a body, and it sort of has to be somewhere, and it has to have a home somewhere. And that people have begun to feel that much more powerfully. What the reasons are for that, I'm not entirely sure, but they do feel in Europe that really, well, after all, they may be Frenchmen, not, you know, Europeans or Germans rather than Europeans, that there's something very specific about themselves in a very specific place where they belong. Now, if that's a trend, then it is the case that Israel may play some role in that development, at least here I would offer as a healthy way of resolving these things. Yes, we are going to have, you know, modern democratic principles and a certain kind of universal understanding, but we're also going to be living in some place, and that place is our home.
In this regard, is it a little easier for Israel to assert, to come back to the war, to assert the idea of a national identity, or like, yes, obviously we're Israelis because all of our neighbors keep telling us around, we can't cross those borders, we can't go there, we are the people who live here. It's a little easier. I mean, obviously we know the cost of that, but if we're talking about, because I'm just not sure that a lot of people feel dislocations, feel the actual dislocations, but it's just not clear to me that most people are like, oh, wait, so it's globalism. That's what these guys in Washington or New York or Silicon Valley have in mind. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Now I get it. It's globalism. Well, that's goofy, right? I mean, I just think that a lot of people do feel the dislocations, but the actual nature of the way some people are arguing about it, I'm not sure. But again,
I think that's true. I think that perhaps because we're just at the beginning of this, people haven't reflected deeply enough to have clear arguments.
That is interesting. You're right. The argument has not been that clear. It's still not clear.
But you know, it was put by someone suspect, Marine Le Pen, as the difference. You know, the struggle now. I think she said, "There's no left. There's no right. There's globalists. There's patriots," and I think, whatever her inclinations are, she's onto something, that is the way that people are beginning to feel that as the divide and as the tension, and a lot of people are drawn to the notion of patriotism. Now, Israel, you know, this was what struck me being there last week in Jerusalem Day, about 60,000 children marching with flags down the street, happy with their country, supportive of it, not in any vicious way, and so forth. That's a different. That's different than the image people have of patriotism.
I want to open it up for questions in one second, but before we do that, I want to ask Mike about, because we are kind of talking about your essay, your American interest essay. Hallel put it one way, or quoting Marine Le Pen, putting it one way, but the way you put it is, Leila and I were speaking about your essay last night, but somewhere people and nowhere people?
Anywhere people.
Anywhere people. Okay, so
somewhere people.
Same thing. So could you just talk about that for a second, and then we'll
open it up?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so just in an effort to get at what Hillel was just describing, it seems to me that across the West now, and I stole this idea from David Goodhart in London, who was trying to make sense of British politics in light of the Brexit debate. And he said that Britain is divided now between the anywhere people and the somewhere people. Anywhere people are well-educated and they're engaged in professions that they can do anywhere. So if they lose their job in Manchester, they can move to London. If they lose their job in London, they can move to Paris or to New York. And they work in the media. They work in software development and so on and so forth. The anywhere people live in a place. They live in a place, and they don't have a lot of mobility. They're less mobile. They're less flexible. And if industry leaves their town, they're stuck in their town with no industry. The anywhere people make up about two-thirds. I mean, the somewhere people make up about two-thirds of the population, but the anywhere people run the show. They run our politics. And I think the same thing is true in America now. This is what the Trump election is. We got the anywhere people in Los Angeles and New York who are interpreting our politics in the media to the country, and then we have the rest of the country, which is predominantly a somewhere place, and they're not buying the presentation of our politics to themselves.
And it's interesting how you have connected this before for this vocabulary, for this language that you have now. You have connected this before, I know, in our conversations. You have connected, well, these are the kinds of people, and they're not just evangelicals, but the people who have strong feelings about their country. These are the kinds of people, Americans, who tend to support Israel.
Yeah, well, we're far away. Yeah, to move it back to the 67 war, I mean, there's a way in which Americans project their own fight about the character of America and its place in the world onto Israel. And so if you take a position on Israel, you're taking a position on the United States, right? That's why Fox News has, that's why Sarah Palin, when she was the,
Vice President.
When she was the governor of Alaska, she had an Israeli flag on her, in her office, right? And that's not because she had a lot of Jewish donors. There are six Jews in Alaska, and only
they have their own name.
Only four.
They have what?
They have their own name.
Frozen Chosen.
Yeah.
The Frozen Chosen. Yeah. So, anyway, recently I was driving in
You're welcome for Mike setting you up for that. You owe him.
In the middle of nowhere in Texas and off the highway, you know, up on a hill, there was a shack with this huge flagpole. At the top of the flag was an Israeli flag. I guarantee that was not a Jew that was living out there. And then you have the universities who are, you know, profoundly uncomfortable with Israel. And the first academic organization to vote in favor of the BDS in the United States wasn't the Middle Eastern Studies Association, which is expected. It was the American Studies Association.
That's very interesting.
And these are people that study, you know, Latino transgender truck drivers, and this is how you get ahead in American studies. If I put a map of Israel in front of them and ask them to identify the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem, they couldn't even find it, right? But they're not talking about. It's an exaggeration. Some of them could find it, okay? But they're not talking about Israel.
Right.
They're not talking about Israel at all. They're talking about America.
And the amazing thing, just to kind of get back to what you both said, I mean, in Israel, when this debate rages on as it is, it really is very hard to be in anywhere when anywhere you turn. There's like a border an hour later telling you, oh, no, absolutely not.
Right.
You're firmly a somewhere.
Well, no, that's what I meant. I mean, yeah. It's like you can't cross that border, even if you, right.
One element that enters into this and makes the whole thing unpredictable for the future, it seems to me, is this, that it's partially what you just said in your original question, whether it's because people have a positive view of Israel, or whether they just feel they have to defend it, and reminded that they're other. Israel, that's just its situation. But I would say that, you know, on the whole, Israelis have tried to make a virtue of a necessity and say we have a positive vision for why we're different. But you don't face that in many parts of the world because your country isn't under attack. You don't have to serve as a soldier and so forth. That era may come to an end, and this is another reason I think that people.
You mean that era for the rest of the world?
World, yes. I mean, especially those parts of it that have gotten very used to thinking of themselves as safe, and borders don't matter, and so forth and so on. Namely, Europe. I think part of the relationship between the United States and Israel. Has something to do with the fact that at least some Americans still, first of all, America still thinks it has to defend itself, and by the way, quite a few other people, and still has to fight. So that gives you a very different outlook on the somewhere or anywhere issue.
We're going to run a few minutes late because of the fire. The fire alarm. In the meantime, let's take a few questions. I saw if you can, Shoshana, if someone with a microphone can come down the center aisle here. The woman right here. Shoshana, if you could identify yourself to the rest of the
rest. Shoshana Bryan from the Jewish Policy Center. And I'd like to go back to the war. I was surprised to hear the words land for peace there in relation to UN Resolution 242. Land for peace assumes that if Israel wants peace, it has to give up land. 242 not only doesn't say that, it inverts the process. The Arabs are required to give Israel respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence, and secure and recognize boundaries free from threats or acts of force. Interestingly, the only two countries that did that are the two countries with peace with Israel, and that's Egypt and Jordan, Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. All this peace process stuff is backwards, it seems to me. Asking Israel to do a variety of things in order to induce the Arabs to give it peace when 242 says the opposite, they have to give, and then you make boundaries. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you want to end the 67 war, which really hasn't ended, don't you have to go back to 242?
Mike, do you want to, since you raised the issue, would you like to? I just want to say, thanks, Shoshana, and also it's very interesting, the idea that the 67 war has not ended. It was very interesting. Thanks. Mike, if you would.
Well, I see it a little differently in that I don't think the 48 war has ended.
Okay.
I think that the that there's a there's
is 19 is 1897 over?
It's too early to tell. It's too early to tell. There's an effort to define if I understand you correctly, there's an effort to define the conflict in a very specific way. And there are a lot of people who, for a whole host of reasons, some of which include that they really see it that way. I'm talking about in the Arab world, they actually see it that way. But then there are a lot of others who don't. And you only need to listen to what Hamas says and to what the Iranians say and to what the Syrians say and so on to see that, or Hezbollah says, to see that that the armistice lines of 1948 are not really the issue. I don't know that this diplomatic formula or that diplomatic formula is the key to bringing about peace. I think it's part of this larger problem of the non-acceptance of Israel in the land.
There's a gentleman over here, so if you can hold on 1 second, and then if you would wait for the microphone. And if you would stand and identify yourself, please.
Abraham Avidor, and thank you so much for your interesting and thoughtful presentations.
Thank you.
Retired Foreign Service, and 50 years ago I happened to serve as a young lieutenant in the Israeli Air Force. So I'd like to share a few personal observations. The first one.
I'm sorry, sir, if you could just keep it to a question that you direct at someone. That'll move a lot easier because I want to get to a few.
Can I just
questions.
Make two quick observations? First of all,
how about you make one observation?
Okay. Okay, the transformation of the country from being under siege to becoming a regional superpower after the war. The country doubled, the population quadrupled. The population increased by 2 million people. The size of the country quadrupled. The mood changed from anxiety to euphoria, and the consequence of the occupation were not well understood at the time. And finally, the contribution of the Air Force. The war started on Monday, June the 5th, 8 o'clock in the morning, when the entire Israeli Air Force was launched, except for a few planes. After low altitude flying, they bombed Egyptian airfields, both on the Sinai Desert and on the right and left side of the Nile and the Suez Canal. 309 out of 340 Egyptian planes were destroyed on the ground. And after that, the Air Force worked around the clock, sortie after sortie, to bomb targets both in the West Bank and in Golan Heights after both Jordan and Syria joined the war. The tanks
I'm sorry, thanks. I really need to move on to another question. Thank you very much. There's a gentleman in the back, Doug.
Hi, I'm Doug Fife. I'm a fellow here at Hudson. You raised...
Which you?
All of you discussed the change in attitude toward Israel after 67, I think you all referred to it one way or another. Israel was treated in the United States very favorably at the time of the Six Days War. It was almost kind of a romantic celebration of Israel's victory in American magazines. I mean, I remember it as a kid, Life magazine had the big spreads celebrating the Israeli victory. That attitude obviously changed radically rather quickly after the 67 war. There was also, as Mike Duran was highlighting, the general idea that the Arab-Israeli conflict was the Arab states versus Israel, that rather soon transformed into a view that the conflict was fundamentally between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I'm wondering if you could just reflect a bit. I'd be interested in your thoughts on how and why those transformations in the way the world, in the way Americans in particular, but the world in general, viewed the Arab-Israeli conflict from the point of view of sympathy toward Israel and from the point of view of the nature of the conflict, you know, who are the Israelis fighting? Why did that happen? When did that happen? And I'd just be interested in your thoughts on the transformation.
Halel and Mike, if you can answer that quickly, because I want to see if we can get to one more question.
Well, I don't think it happened that quickly, Doug, and it certainly hasn't happened completely. But as I think Mike said before, a lot of the fight about Israel in the end turns out to be a fight about ourselves, about us Americans, and it has a lot to do with the development of the right and the left over time in this country, especially the left, and that's clearest, you know, every four years now at the Democratic Party convention, when resolutions supportive of Israel either can't get passed at all or are very weak. So really one has to look at that, I think, much more than really what anything that happened particularly with Israel. The one big thing was, of course, the oil shock in the 70s, but by now that's pretty much worn off.
Mike, do you want to? Leal, if you have something to say, too. Mike, if you
I see two big trends. The one is the one I mentioned, that the Arab state, not just Egypt, but the Arab states in general, want to disengage. They see the continued conflict with Israel as too costly for them. I mean, the 67 showed the Egyptians that the Israelis can really, really cost them a lot. And shutting down the Suez Canal, right, is a huge economic blow to Egypt, not just the military blow of the war. And that goes beyond just the Egyptians. They want to disengage. And they find a convenient way to disengage is to put the PLO forward and say, oh, it's their conflict, not ours. And it's not a total disengagement, but it's a partial disengagement. But there's also a very savvy calculation behind this, and that has to do with the shift in the West and attitudes in the West, and particularly in the United States, as a result of the Vietnam War. Because if you think of Carter's speech at Notre Dame after he's elected, this is a famous speech where he says that there's been an inordinate fear of communism, right? So what's the interpretation? The Carter interpretation of the Vietnam War is that this was a war of national liberation, which the United States and its Manichaean vision, which the Republicans, right, in their Manichaean vision of international politics and seeing a zero-sum game between good and evil, between the United States and communism, saw this war of national liberation as a fight between the United States and the Soviet Union, and we went and we militarized our foreign policy, and we put all of this, expended all this blood and treasure, and for what? If we just would have realized that it was a problem of national self-determination, we could have worked with the Soviets, come to an agreement, and everything would have been fine. So that template starts to become the template through which the American elite, and the Carter administration in particular, is looking at global politics. We have been too muscular, too militaristic, too Manichaean, right? And the Arabs recognize that, and they put the PLO forward. And so you find the Carter administration comes in immediately, on day one, with two absolute firm convictions, One is that the Palestinian self-determination is the core of the conflict. And number two, we have to bring the Soviets in and we can work with them. And we're going to have a general conference and the two of us are going to sit down together and solve this thing.
Liel? Okay.
Hey, man.
So we'll have time for the gentleman right here in the blue jacket and the yellow.
All right, thank you. My question is sort of moving past the 67 war and looking forward today, things I think of a lot different. We have Israel sort of a regional power, militarily, economically, still a democracy, and then you have the Trump administration and Iran. So if we could sort of look forward now, what's the global strategic sort of view? I think maybe Mike, if you could address that.
Why don't we do a speed round here as our final question before everyone goes? Who would like, Mike, would you like to kick off the speed round? And I do mean speed round. Giving you 45 seconds.
Right. So
Liel is going to get a minute and a half.
You just took some of my seconds.
Sorry.
You just threw me off my game here. If you think about what I just said, you know, Nixon to Carter, you can map that onto Bush to Obama. Right? Obama came in, we militarized our foreign policy, we engaged in a thankless war. And we need to pull back and be less militaristic, and that goes hand in glove with peace process, right? That's the key way that we show the rest of the world that we want to find diplomatic solutions to problems without nasty muscular America. Trump comes in. Trump is a hybrid between Bush and Obama. What Trump said in the campaign was, "I'm going to give you more with less." I'm going to give you more than President Obama gave you, because he was unwilling to use military force and to flex America's muscles. Not me. You're going to see muscular America, but I'm going to do it with less than George Bush did, because George Bush got involved in all these thankless, initiatives like spreading democracy around the world. Not me. I'm going to focus on narrow national interests, and so you find that there's a tension in the Trump administration. The narrow national interest people who are thinking like Obama about pulling back, right? They want peace process, and they want to they're wary of Israel because the support for Israel correlates to muscular policy.
That was fantastic.
The other people think the opposite.
Aside from the extra minute you took, Halal, please. 45 seconds.
Okay,
not a Duran 45 seconds.
I think you're mostly, in a way, asking about Iran. And I would say, right.
I have the answer on Iran, but he stopped me.
Look, it boils down to this. Iran will get a bomb unless someone stops them. And if they get a bomb, then we will have not only an Iranian bomb, but we'll have further proliferation. No one has a clue as to what that would mean, how dangerous it would be. You asked, people have to prepare now for what's going to happen in 10 years out, and it may not take 10 years.
Liel?
I have little to add on the physical sense. On the metaphysical sense, I think that attitudes are changing, and they're changing very dramatically. To answer Mr. Feith's question also, I think that part of the problem is that we have spent about 50 years looking for the penny under the lamplight, hoping that if we could only define the combatants in the correct way and only construct some sort of framework for reconciliation, it's just around the corner. I think we're moving away from that. I think Israel is moving away from that politically, which is why you're seeing rise of political forces there that were sort of unimaginable before. I think America is too. And I think in a really interesting way, it would open really new and hopeful coalitions of people around the world, not necessarily maybe here in the United States, but I think much of the rapprochement of sorts between Israel and, say, India and China has to do with that actually very similar way of seeing the world and understanding long-term interests. And to me, that is a dramatically hopeful change. I think a lot of the what we have seen, courtesy of the last president, propelled us into an era in which the chances for collaboration between Israel and the Saudis, certainly the Egyptians, is interesting, to say the least. And so there are a lot of reasons to be very hopeful. There are just none of the reasons that we would have imagined, say, 5 years ago.
Interesting. Lael, thank you. Mike, thank you. Hillel, thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to Hudson and C-SPAN as well. Thank you.
Wow.
Thanks.
Thank you.